Wednesday night edition of the Downtown Basketball Podcast. Going to do the Twitter NBA show here. Wanted to talk about the Warriors-Hornets game, which is the national game. Took a lot of interesting Periscope and Twitter questions. Talked about Carmelo Anthony potentially going to Cleveland, whether we would do that deal if we were Cleveland. I actually had a somewhat surprising answer on that, I think. And then we also picked our All-Star reserves as well. Danny and I with a little difference of opinion on the West, which was really, really hard to do. So without further ado, the Twitter NBA show, a reminder too that we are sponsored today by the Draft app. Really fun daily fantasy snake drafts. Give you almost three times better chance of winning than in traditional salary cap leagues. Use that cap space code and they will double your deposit up to $600. Welcome replay viewers. Twitter NBA show post game here. We're going to be doing this now instead of the Warrior or the Lakers and Blazers game because that's not going to be a very good game. 113-103 the final for Golden State. We're going to talk about this game. Also pick our All-Star reserves, which we've been looking forward to doing, and the usual, of course, plenty of great Twitter questions using that hashtag Twitter NBA show, and we will take your Periscope questions live as well. Where do you want to start tonight?
Well, I think we have to start with the very end of the game. The Warriors turn to the fabled death lineup in its current iteration, which had struggled enough that I think you're the one who proposed that we stop calling it that. I think we can consider...
I really waffle on that, though, yeah. I think, right?
Like, yeah, I do too.
I kind of want to bring it back now after these last two games.
But so it was at the 550 mark, technically 552, they went back to it, and we're not going to count Kevin Durant's free throws because those were drawn during that time period. The Warriors outscored Charlotte 20-9, 7 of 11 from the field versus 4 of 9 for Charlotte. Absolutely dominant performance from that group. And my point with that, what was the most impressive thing to really talk about, is that most teams do not have the ability to counter that lineup because they have to make a choice, and that choice is untenable.
Yeah, because who else has Kevin Durant and who else has Draymond Green as guys who can still be great defenders? And then he's not really a rim protector in the air, but Andre Iguodala also has great hands. Steph Curry has great hands. So you have four guys who can either get blocks or steals. And even if you're going to be able to get on in, you're still going to have a struggle to finish, or you may get a lot of turnovers before you can even take advantage of them being small. And so they tried going with Marvin Williams at the five. We saw one play where Marvin was guarding Steph. Steph drove past him, and there's nobody else with the help instincts really to protect the rim for most of these teams. We've seen the Blazers, another team that will try going small with like Aminu at the five, and that usually fails against that Golden State group. The only team that really has had success, we saw Oklahoma City do it when they had Serge Ibaka at center and Kevin Durant coincidentally on their team, and they also had two guys in Westbrook and Waiters who were really strong, able to stop anybody from posting up and switch. And then of course the Cavs as well, with LeBron James playing at an all-world defensive level, you know, that few have reached in that last final.
The end of the game also obscured a very nice third quarter, especially the first half of the third quarter from the Charlotte Hornets. They were able to score. Nick Batum went crazy in that third quarter, was making a ton of shots. Kemba Walker did a nice job as well, but they just didn't have enough to sustain it. And one of the other differences between these two teams came into play in the fourth quarter, because Charlotte chose to sit Batum and Kemba Walker at the same time, and that opened up the Warriors going on a little bit of a run, except for Marco Bellinelli getting fouled on three-point shots twice.
Yeah, we saw Charlotte do well in the third quarter, as you mentioned. Batum going to his right, his jumper is much better than going to his left. They eventually adapted to take that away later on. And I mean, I don't know that having Batum not out there mattered that much, because they couldn't score either. I mean, that was the key stretch of the game, really, as the Warriors were able to take the lead because they were just switching everything, and Charlotte didn't have anyone who could go one-on-one. I would have liked to have seen them maybe go into the post a little bit more. Posting up, not a great option, but guys like Kaminsky and Hawes, they can do a little something with their back to the basket, and they were getting so little offensively that at some point that becomes a better option than just trying to go one-on-one against guys you can't beat off the dribble.
That's a really good point, and it's not a great situation, but you have to make do with what you have. And I just think it was an interesting reflection of kind of some of the issues that the Warriors have, and some great play from the Hornets in the third quarter. But then the Warriors, one of the trademarks of this season is that anytime they've had struggles, they've had another stretch which just kind of washed it all away. And most teams can't pull that off. Most teams don't get that sort of circumstance. The best have that fastball. I mean, Cleveland functionally erased a 70-50 halftime deficit against the Pelicans a couple days ago just because they're that good. They end up losing that game anyway, but the Warriors can have some of those bad stretches, survive it and win.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we've seen now, encouragingly for them, they've had very good clutch performances with that unit, with Green at center. That unit had struggled earlier, struggled to beat switching defenses. They did well against Miami. They did well against Miami down the stretch. The time they played in the in Oakland, they did well against Sacramento with that unit down the end. So it's starting now, they're able to summon that clutch juju that it seemed had abandoned them early in the year, culminating in that ugly Memphis loss.
Kevin Durant was fabulous in the fourth quarter, getting to the line, and MKG is somebody who you would love to be able to handle Kevin Durant, but there aren't that many individuals who can, and Durant got to the line. He ended the game with 10 free throws and made all 10 of them. He's actually had some strange struggles from the line
this year.
A lot
in transition, too, where you really can't do anything with him at all.
Right, and so he ended the game with 33 points on 11 of 20 from the field, but then 10 of 10 from the line. Steph Curry had two really hot stretches in the first quarter, and then he had a nice stretch at the end of the fourth quarter. 28 points on 11 of 23 from the field, 6 of 12 from three. He's closing in on Rashard Lewis for, I believe, it's 12th all time in made threes, which is ludicrous considering he's still on his second NBA contract.
He probably took three threes from beyond 30 feet, which he didn't make any of them, but all of them were close.
Yeah, and that doesn't even include the three quarter court shot that he almost made too.
Yeah, that one looked good the moment it left his hands. For Charlotte, they got contributions out of really three support guys who haven't played quite as well this year. MKG, 15 points. Batum with 16. Marvin Williams with 14. Marvin looking pretty spry athletically. He has not looked that way a lot of the time this year. But I think this Charlotte team, again, what killed them was the bench, right? Like, Walker was plus three in a game that they lost by 10. Bellinelli, negative 16 in the plus minus. Sessions, 10 minutes, negative 13. Kaminsky, negative 9 in 18 minutes. Hawes was negative 14. He played 29 minutes. So it was really this Charlotte bench. They had a good bench last year. That was really one of the big reasons why they surprised last year. And they may need to go get some help, but they have limited resources at their disposal.
This is something that you keyed on more than I did when we were going into their offseason, was that they were going to have hard choices to make. And we always knew that, but I thought that they would be able to get enough from the guys that they were holding over, losing Lynn, losing, why can't I remember the second guy? Courtney Lee, who's done a pretty good job for the Knicks. And they haven't really been able to replace those guys. Hornets University is not exactly there yet, especially with Jeremy Lamb being hurt. Even though Steve Clifford doesn't love him, he's a good player, and I'd like to see him in this mix. He's not perfect. Nobody is. And Bellinelli had some nice stretches in this game, but again, going back to the idea of defending the Warriors with Draymond at center, there isn't a place to hide him against that lineup, and you pretty much need a place for him, but you have other players that are offensive priorities too.
Yeah, and
we'll take a quick break to tell you about the Draft app. On Draft, it's draft day every day. It's a simple daily fantasy app that uses snake drafts instead of a salary cap. And the reason that's better is because you have almost three times better chance of winning over traditional salary cap leagues, because it's harder to submit multiple entries and submit the same lineup. You can't anticipate exactly how a draft is going to go. On Draft, you can play for free or you can play for money without having to spend hours a day doing it to make anything. So to get started with them, you can download the Draft app. Just search Draft in the App Store, whether it's Android or Apple, it'll come up first. And be sure to enter the promo code CAPSPACE, A, to let them know that you came from us, and B, because you can be entered into the Dunked On League when you download using that code. And C, most importantly, you'll get a 100% bonus up to $600 when you deposit. So you put in $100, they will match your deposit with $100 as well. So search Draft in the App Store. Be sure to enter the promo code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. And get started with a more fun way, easier way, and potentially more lucrative way for the average player to do daily fantasy. That's the Draft app.
I wanted them to re-sign Courtney Lee. They're going to be locked in cap-wise anyway. Why not just do that rather than trade, sign Hibbert and then trade that 22nd pick for Marco Bellinelli? They could have gotten something else for that that would have been cheaper, or maybe even just try to get a pick further in the future, something along those lines, because I think they really miss Courtney Lee a lot, and that would have enabled them to go smaller with MKG at the four, maybe come a little bit closer to guarding a team like Golden State, or just go small more themselves. What else we got on this game here?
Let's take Periscope questions throughout, just to give you a heads up of where we're going with this. We're going to talk a little bit about the rumor of the offer from Kevin Love for Carmelo Anthony that got rebuffed by the Cavs, but mostly we're going to focus on All-Star reserves. Nate and I each spent the time to make our picks there. I don't know if we're going to have arguments, but we'll certainly have a discussion about it.
But, well, we'll certainly have arguments with the Periscope.
Yes. So. We'll probably have more arguments in the Western Conference than the Eastern Conference, but we also have some Twitter questions using hashtag TwitterNBAShow, and Periscope questions are welcome the whole time. One Twitter question that I had that I thought was interesting, and I'm not sure if we have an answer for this, but from at MSUNC, which I'm guessing relates to the University of North Carolina, what's a realistic trade to help the Hornets, something to improve their second unit at point guard or power forward?
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to make a trade to improve at power forward because that's Kaminsky. He's the apple of, I would assume, Michael Jordan's eye. That's why he got drafted. I highly doubt they're willing to give up
over
on him
Miles
yet.
Turner.
Or over the treasure trove of picks that the Celtics reportedly offered to try to move up and get Justice Winslow. I don't think they're going to try to upgrade there. I think backup center is somewhere where it might be nice to upgrade, but with Hibbert and Hawes, they already have over $10 million included there. Bellinelli, they just traded for. I think that they seem to like those guys. They seem to believe that they would be good players. I don't know that they really have been at this point. And when you're going with MKG, a lot of times can't stay on the floor at the end of games, so they go with Bellinelli. He's not really a good enough player to be closing games for a good team at this point in his career. Probably really never in his career was he at that point. He's more of a bench guy. So you're looking at really having to trade a first round pick to upgrade your bench. I don't know that that's really worth it. Those first rounders, because they are capped out for so long in the future now, I don't know if you want to give up on a first rounder. And then you would have to probably, whoever you're trading for, you got to send out some salary that's not going to be great salary. That complicates matters as well. So I don't really know what's out there for them to improve necessarily, unless there's some kind of pending free agent. But I mean, the other thing too is they're not close to really doing anything this year.
Do you want this to be the year where you sell out and go for it? They're not nearly good enough to make the NBA finals or probably even the conference finals. So it's a strange time to buy now. Maybe you hope that you can thread the needle with somebody like Tyus Jones. If for whatever reason Tom Thibodeau wants to sell low on him, yeah, you could consider something like that. He's a way to bridge this gap because he's cheap for another couple of years, and he could end up being better, you know, than what he has been so far for the Wolves, which has been better than the way that Thibodeau has played him. But those circumstances are few and far between, and the challenge for Charlotte in this case is you also have to have the best off. You know, like, even if you identify the right talent, first of all, a team might want to hold on to that guy, but also if it's somebody who's good, they don't have much in the way of assets, so you're going to have to overpay, whether it's overpaying in terms of salary now or overpaying in terms of assets.
I mean, their time really was last year. Batum was having the season of his life. Walker was playing well, not quite as well as he's played so far this year. He's taken a step forward. They didn't have MKG last year, but he, I think, is disappointed despite his strong game tonight. I mean, that if they had been able to stay healthy, I think they could have beaten Miami. They almost did anyway, yeah. But then Zeller got injured. Jeremy Lin got injured in game five. He wasn't the same after that. Batum sprained his ankle in the first game of that series. Wasn't ever the same. If they could have beaten Miami, I think they could have given Toronto a very good series, maybe made it to the East Finals to inevitable decapitation by Cleveland, but that would be by far the greatest season in Hornets history. And now it seems like they really, because of the lack of depth, have fallen back into the morass of the East. Maybe they can get the 4 seed. Looks like they're going to be behind Atlanta. It could be in the 4-5 matchup with them. Probably a first round exit is what they're looking at, and I don't particularly see a path forward for them at this point.
Their depth is also a problem when you think about regular season success, because they would be helped a lot by getting a higher seed and just kind of keeping themselves propped up. But when you're shallow, any injury, any scheduled rest makes that much harder. And if Atlanta is kind of starting to move in front of them and a lot of the other teams, you have to beat everybody else probably. And beating everybody else will take some good fortune. It will take playing well. And the Hornets certainly can do it. But being the 5 seed, you know, that probably means you have a puncher's chance, better than a puncher's chance in the first round. And then you're going to run into the buzzsaw, even if that buzzsaw is not as sharp as it was last year.
Let's get to a few Periscope questions.
Sure.
Tyler Y. Amat, sorry if I'm butchering that one. Is Kemba all-star caliber? Oh, you shall find out very shortly when we
yes.
do our all-star reserves, but we cannot reveal that.
That yes is saying that we will find out, not yes that he is making it. But
So let's see here. A few other ones kind of on this game. Same guy, actually. I kind of like this one. What's another good death lineup besides Golden State? So I guess we're just thinking of what some of the best lineups are. I don't know whether that has to be a small ball lineup necessarily, but just the best actual lineups in the NBA. You have to say anything with those Clippers core four in it.
Yeah.
It would be in there. I mean, I think anything with LeBron James at the four for Cleveland has been really good.
I think there are some lineups with the Spurs, even some that they haven't even trotted out yet. Maybe with Deadman at center. That
I mean, could... I would love to see. I mean, I guess the problem is then you have to play LaMarcus at the five. You're not going to take him off the floor. But some lineups with Kawhi Leonard at the four, I would really like to see there. And also, actually, one I'd like, we were talking about this before the show, that I'd really like to see is Gordon Hayward at the four for Utah with Rudy Gobert. You could put, they have a lot of wing depth. They're blessed with that. So guys like Ingles, Burks, Rodney Hood, George Hill is a good defender at the one. He can switch some. Play Hayward at the four. I think that could be a very difficult offensive group to stop. We have not seen that too much from Utah yet, but something I might like to see more of.
A lot of lineup creativity ideas for various teams, but I think that's kind of part of the idea of this is going small, trying something that's a little bit out of your comfort zone. And I understand why coaches don't always do that, but a lot of the best lineups are unconventional at this point in the game. Also, they as many of your best players as you can get on the floor, it's generally a good idea.
So a few other things we got to talk about from this Warriors-Charlotte game before we move on. The Warriors had a 31.5% two-point block rate in this game, leading Charlotte to 20 of 39 shooting in the restricted area. 39 is a ton of shots. Part of that, again, fueled by offensive rebounds. A lot of it fueled, again, by block shots. I mean, this Warriors team, I don't know if they're leading the league in blocks, but they're, like, pretty darn close.
One, when you think about all the putbacks they had, to have that sort of a block rate with all those bunnies that they gave up is even more impressive.
Yeah. Also interesting on the stat line here, Warriors, 60% true shooting, which is excellent, obviously. 116 offensive rating. It was a slower game than most Warriors games. 97 possessions. Usually they'll be over 100 or so. And I mean, I think this game was kind of deceptively close in the sense that Charlotte was making some ridiculous shots in the third quarter. You talked about what Batum did. Bellinelli, those 2-3 shot fouls. I talked to an executive at the D-League Showcase because I was kind of taking everyone's temperature on just like, you know, what are some of the rule changes you'd like to see? Like, what's the state of the league? And he's the only one who said this, but I thought it was an interesting point. He thinks that just 3 shot fouls, there's just a scourge of 3 shot fouls at this point. There's too many of them. And that, and he didn't say this, but I thought maybe what would you think of just changing 3 shot fouls to 2 shot fouls, except when you're in, like, you know, the last 2 minutes of the game?
I don't necessarily love that because there's a behavior that you're trying to discourage, which is not all behavior. So, like, there are times when you foul 3-point shooters and you don't want that to be advantageous because then theoretically, if a team was down 3, oh, yeah, but then you're saying in the last 2 minutes. So I don't love that as a solution, but I like the idea of trying, you know, just seeing if it works. But I think that there needs to be something, even if it's retroactive punishment, it's not the perfect thing for those circumstances when a guy does an unnatural shooting motion. You might not be able to make the call right on the court every single time, but if you can hit a guy in the pocketbook or some sort of cumulative punishment, it helps. It's something. It's something small, but it's something.
All right. Anything else you wanted to talk about in this one?
No. And we have some good questions, but I think what we should do, well, do you want to do the Cavs-Knicks kind of rumor reporting, or do you want to do Rizzo?
Yeah, let's hit that first, actually. I mean, I think we'll get a lot of commentary on that. Feel free to provide that on Periscope. We will try to get those questions as they come in. But so it was reported by Chris Haynes today of ESPN that the Cavs and Knicks, the Knicks engaged the Cavs in discussions on whether they would do a Carmelo Anthony for Kevin Love trade. The Cavs rebuffed that offer, apparently, according to Haynes. He's pretty plugged in Cleveland, so I probably believe that. Were they right to rebuff that offer if, in fact, that was a real offer, if in fact Carmelo were willing to waive his note?
This is a very easy answer. Yes. When I was working through the idea of this, Carmelo is still a talented basketball player, but what he brings is not something Cleveland needs that much. And when you think about the idea of a best 5-man lineup, he doesn't stretch the floor. He doesn't play particularly good defense. He doesn't give you that sort of versatility there. You can play Love at the five. If you get Melo, that exacerbates some of your defensive issues. And I would go even a step further. I started fiddling with the trade checker, Real GM's great trade checker. And if we're including reasonable trades, so that means not like J.R. Smith and Amon Shumpert for Carmelo Anthony, because that's not a reasonable trade. It's not one that the Knicks would accept. I don't think there's a way to make a deal work between these two.
What if the Knicks threw something else in, which I think they should? I think Love is probably the better asset, he's younger.
Like,
and I'll get to
a first round pick?
Either that or maybe another guy out of their rotation who can play a little bit, who might help Cleveland.
One of their young bigs?
Yeah, like a Willie Hernan Gomez, someone who could play like a little center. They don't really have much in the way of backup center. Fry is, maybe doesn't quite have the toughness at this stage of his career that you might like, at least for like regular season duty.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems for Cleveland in this sense is that they don't have filler salary. They have guys that are they're guys that make money that aren't central to their success.
Even like a Lance Thomas could help Cleveland. Someone like that.
Actually, Lance would be a nice fit.
Yeah, who could give him more versatility against Golden State. So you'd still be against it even in that scenario.
I think you're convincing me that you could concoct a scenario, but it gets complicated, and I don't think it necessarily makes Cleveland better in that sense. Like, what do you think about the Melo fit?
I think everyone is like, no, it's a no-brainer not to trade him. It's not that obvious to me. I'll say that to begin with, and I haven't thought about it quite as deeply as I'd like to, but I think they're a better offensive team if they have Melo. Do you agree with me on that? Like, we're talking about just this season now. Obviously, with Love being younger, we've got future seasons to deal with, but, you know, the time is kind of right now for them.
Well, too. I mean, the logic there is that international Melo is a better representation than Knicks Melo of what he can be, because he'll need to pass the ball a lot. We can't stick with him. If it sticks with him, then it doesn't make them better.
I think Carmelo is a better offensive player than Love. They'll play small more too. LeBron will just be the four at that point, or Melo will be. I think that Melo, for all of his defensive faults, can still guard the perimeter and switch better than Kevin Love can. They'll take a
he
hit
can do
on
it
the...
at the four, but at the but he can't play the five.
Yeah, no, that's true. But then, I mean, you could even have LeBron at the five. They still have Tristan Thompson too. They would be very, very difficult to guard, and your switching isn't going to work as well then, because I think Carmelo can attack switches even better than Love can. Lose a little on the offensive glass, lose a lot on the defensive glass.
Ton.
I'm not even willing to say for sure, because Love at least tries defensively. He is very slow in pick and roll, despite that one stop against Steph Curry. Like, I'm not willing to call him some awesome defensive player out on the perimeter. I'm not sure that it makes them, I think Love in general is a better player than Carmelo, but for what they need, and especially who they're playing against. I mean, this is basically, we're talking about against the Warriors too, like, because that's all we care about. They're making the finals, we're going to think, despite the fact that they had another terrible loss today to Sacramento, but we'll assume they're going to get their shit together. I think that for this year, it's arguable. I think Carmelo could make them better. And then if you could also pick up some depth in that trade as well, I would very seriously consider. I think, and it's probably surprising for a lot of people that I would have that opinion, but it's not a no-brainer to me at all.
It's not a no-brainer, but I'm just less sold on Melo's fit offensively and defensively. I think you're asking the world of LeBron James in that circumstance, and if you're going to ask the world of anybody, LeBron James is a fair person to ask it of him. But you lose, unless you can get Lance Thomas back in the deal, and then you start talking about some really good lineups.
I think that you should be able to, from the Knicks' perspective, Love and Porzingis would be an interesting combination as
right.
well.
Right, and I think they would actually be a circumstance where you might want to try even, like, I use the term a stagger plus, where you actually separate them but then play them together, because both those guys deserve plenty of minutes, and you could work a lot of things in terms of combination. Even if they keep Kyle O'Quinn, use O'Quinn as the third guy, and also maybe get their books more in line, which is something that would be useful for them. And I would say Love is a much better complementary piece for a Porzingis based team than Melo is, just because of his role in the offense.
Yeah, and then you're going to be playing KP at center, obviously, with Love at the four. Love could help out with some of Porzingis's defensive rebounding issues. You're not going to stop anybody probably with that front court.
And also you have two bigs that are both capable as pick and pop players and as standstill shooters, which is a very unusual combination where you have guys that can do both. So you can run a high pick and roll with Love, you can run a high pick and roll with Porzingis, and have the other one out there, and they have to respect that guy's shot. So you're creating so much real estate. Like, if I were an aspiring point guard, that would be a perfect situation to just look like $1 million.
Now, for the Cleveland side of this, a lot of it has to do too with the idea of how important is this year versus future years, because with Love being younger, you have to imagine that the next 2 years running, Carmelo will have what, 1 year left and then a player option. Love would have 2 years left after this and a player option, so he's under team control for longer. How long is LeBron really going to be, you know, capital, all capital letters LeBron James, you know, playing at this type of level? I think that's part of it too. If you're like, all right, we got to maximize this year, I think the Carmelo thing, it's arguable whether it makes him better this year. Going forward though, maybe a little bit less so. Again, getting someone else, I mean, even like a Justin Holiday, although he's going to be a free agent, or, you know, Kuzminskas, like somebody who could just play a little bit, be in their wing rotation, allow them again. I mean, I think that we're going to find out that Kevin Love still, I mean, remember, up until he didn't do much in the finals last year, and he had one defensive stop and a few offensive rebounds in that game seven, and now it's like, oh, he's great against the Warriors, when like all of the evidence before that indicated that he wouldn't be as good against them. So I think I might actually do it. Like, I'm like pretty close.
I like that we get a few weeks to think about this, not only before the trade deadline, but also before the mock trade deadline podcast. podcast that we're going to do, because this will be an intense point of discussion in terms of all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I agree that I think Love is underrated a lot. But I think Carmelo is underrated in some ways too. I've cautioned that Carmelo might not be that good, but I just, I'm not sure how useful Love is to Cleveland against Golden State. That's my issue. And I don't think that Carmelo is like some huge defensive downgrade on him either. All right, let's move on here. Should we do our all-star reserves? Are we ready
for
that? Sure.
Do you want to start with the East or do you want to start with the West?
I think let's start with the East because it's easier.
Yeah. So when we talked about how we were going to do this structure, I think the first part that we agreed on was to do a group of inarguables, which are basically players that we don't need to spend time arguing. Actually, a lot of these guys for both conferences will be players that Nate and I believed were starters in the first place. So I don't need to argue that a starter in the first place deserves to make the team because they deserve to start. So yeah. Who are your inarguables?
Well, so we'll review the starters first. Sure. Kyrie Irving and DeMar DeRozan started at guard. We would have both had different starters, as we'll get to.
Yes.
Butler, LeBron, and Giannis, we agreed with all three of those starting in the front court. And then the format off the bench, two guards, three front court, and then two wild cards can be any of either a guard or front court.
So for me, the inarguables for the Eastern Conference, there are only two, but you could argue a third, and if you want to include him, it's fine. Kyle Lowry, Isaiah Thomas, both huge factors on their teams. They were my two starters in the East backcourt. I think you had John Wall, and I have no opposition to John Wall being put in this category as well. They've all had fantastic seasons.
Yeah, I would put Wall there. I actually had him a little ahead of Isaiah Thomas now, just with the Wizards kind of coming on. I think what he's been able to do, although he's not quite at his peak defensively, I think he has improved his effort of late and can still bring it at a really high level in crunch time.
So if we're putting all three of those guys in, then that means both backcourt spots are filled and one of the wild card. So I think at that point, we might as well jump to the front court. We have minimum three spots, but theoretically the last wild card could be front court. Let's start with just who you were considering for this. And is there anybody that you would say is close to inarguable? Because I don't think there's any inarguable, but I think that my three, I feel really strong.
It was really very easy for me this time. I thought there was a clear line of demarcation below the players. I think the only ones that I felt really deserved more of a shot was Joel Embiid. I don't think that he has played enough minutes or enough games yet, despite the fact that he has probably been all-star level when he's been on the floor. I think we can agree with that. But since he only plays 25 minutes a game, and he's missed like 13 games or something now as well, although they keep winning without him now, which is crazy. But so he, just in terms of his level, the other guy just who's a perennial all-star is Carmelo Anthony. Why would he? I assume he didn't make it for you. Why didn't
he? He wasn't at the same level for me, just as an overall difference maker.
And he's just not as good as Paul George or Paul Millsap.
Yeah. So let's actually go through the list. So are your three Kevin Love, Paul Millsap, and Paul George?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Those are the same three for me. Love has had an underrated year, had that huge 34-point quarter.
Yeah.
Early
against the Portland Blazers. Yeah.
So he's had a really nice year, a bounce back after last season, which was largely a disappointment until he became the switching stud for one possession of the finals. But hey, it's the most important defensive possession of his life, so kudos to him for that. But Love's had a great year. Millsap has been awesome.
He's taken a step back offensively,
but defensively,
he's still, that Hawks D is really good. Like, he's very versatile. He's kind of a little more of a regular season player to me, because he just doesn't have, other than that one crazy 46-point game against Boston, he has not really been able to bring it in the playoffs to score one-on-one. But I still think, just in the aggregate, he's probably a better player at this point than Carmelo when you consider like his all-world defense.
The other two players that I wouldn't say I heavily considered them, but I feel we just need to mention them. The two best centers in the Eastern Conference right now, Dwight Howard and Al Horford, both have had good years.
You mean behind Joel Embiid?
Yeah. I mean, I would say Howard has been such a huge part of the Hawks defense.
Yeah, he's having an underrated year.
So
he deserves
Embiid
mention.
Has been better for when he has been on the floor. However, right. Howard has the total value. And as you are a strong advocate for the idea of looking at the overall player quality with Embiid, it's not overall sample because he hasn't played at all. But Dwight Howard has been an all-star many times before, has been a defensive player of the year, and is having a wonderful season. And you give that credit defensively to him and to Millsap. Dwight's had an underrated year, but they're not above any of these guys. I just feel like we need to mention them for the sake of completeness.
Yeah, so we're missing holding one wild card spot now. One has already been taken by Isaiah Thomas, and Kemba Walker to me took the last.
Easily. I didn't even have.
He's just so much better than any of these.
My others considered in this category was just Bradley Beal with a question mark. I think that was the line of separation. And that also gets into an idea. I talked about this on Twitter when the starters came out, that I don't get aggrieved about all-star starters unless those players would not have made the game at all. If they make the game, it's just a matter of distribution. And it increases the risk that a deserving player will not make it in.
Yeah, and it was good that Carmelo and Dwayne Wade did not get voted in. I would say the fans, I wouldn't have gone with Irving or DeRozan, but those guys are both all-star worthy players. I think DeRozan probably would have been close to the bottom of this list for me, but I think he still would have made it over some of these other names we're talking about. Like, you could throw Jabari Parker in there as well. That's probably about it as far as serious consideration for me.
And that's going to make it hard if they have to have any injury replacements. Like, those are actually going to be hard. Where in the West, it's hard, but for an entirely different reason. Is there anybody else you think, or should we move on to the West?
No, I think we should move on to the West. And before we talk about this, I want to talk a little bit more about my personal criteria. For me, a big tiebreaker is just who I think is a better player. If you have more of a track record, I also tend to prioritize creating efficient shots for yourself and others. I think that's the most important skill in the NBA. And so that, I'm not going to harp on that too much, but if you have a good track record, and then also if you're contributing to a winning team, that's a little bit of a tiebreaker for me too. I mean, sort of the new, about 10 years ago when kind of the new advanced stats revolution came on and people, more people outside of the traditional media began talking about all-stars, there was a real pushback against that. But I actually don't mind the idea of guys who are on winning teams getting a little bit of a boost in all-star, because I like the fact that coaches can actually kind of point to that as saying, like, hey, if your team wins, you're going to do better. It's a nice incentive for guys to do the little things that actually help you win, other than just chasing stats, which traditionally have driven all-star.
Right. And I like to separate out, the significance of that player as a part of their winning, as opposed to just being on a winning team. And this is actually going to be something that might come up as a part of one of these differentiators. Like, I would rather have a guy who's more important on a team that's winning a little less but still winning than somebody who's, let's say the fourth best player on the league's best team.
Yeah. Well, we'll see there. So the starters, to reiterate, Stephen Curry controversially made it over Russell Westbrook, who is a lock, obviously, to make it as one of the guard spots on the bench. James Harden in the backcourt, and then Kevin Durant, Kawhi Leonard, and Anthony Davis round out the starting front court for the West. Who is your second guard outside of Westbrook?
Well, so it's not cheating because he deserves the spot, Chris Paul.
Yeah, I agree. He is playing, if anything, better than he played last year. He's an all-time great player. Yeah, he's missed some time with that hamstring and now this hand, but he should be in there. He has the track record too, and so yeah, he should be in there. We're going to replace him as an injury replacement, put on our Adam Silver.
And it's also important to do that in a way, just because it opens things up a little bit creatively, because if you put him in the second guard spot, you can replace him with anybody. I assume that we'll both replace him with a guard, but you don't have to. And then I would say the other person that is inarguable, and I know there are two others we can discuss, is Draymond Green.
I agree.
Green has been phenomenal this year. A defensive player of the year candidate, probably not the favorite for either one of us right now, but also phenomenal offensively and just a pivotal part of the league's best.
Yeah, I would put him really ahead of kind of this next tier now.
Sure.
And we have two other front court spots to fill out. I ended up going with DeMarcus Cousins and Marc Gasol. I did not feel good about Cousins, to be honest, just because I've really soured on him with Sacramento's performance this year. They just have not been good. He has looked decent by advanced metrics at times defensively. That day has passed, though, where you can make any kind of an argument that he's been a good defender this year. He's basically, and this is terrible for a big guy, has almost a negative RPM, pretty close to that, has the slowest average speed of any player in the NBA.
Nice.
And just visibly looks exhausted a lot of times. Rarely gets back on defense. If he misses a shot, he'll always bark for foul calls. He is just not helping them defensively. He also has had to play the four a lot next to Kufos, which granted is not his forte, but I mean, he has hurt the team when he's played there. And when you've been on the floor and you're hurting the team, regardless of whether your coach is putting you in a bad position, that counts. But he's just such a good offensive player. He's the best offensive center in the game. And I do give him a little bit of credence to the idea that it's hard to defend at that level, but he hasn't even really shown flashes defensively the way Anthony Davis
has. And we've seen a big difference. I like that you brought up Davis, because like, there was this argument for a long time about whether, where you wanted to go, Cousins versus Davis, and Davis is a little bit, like, I would say he's a little bit worse offensively, but now Davis at center, the last month, they've been good defensively. Sometimes they've been great, yeah. and the Kings have not. So I feel like there is a line of demarcation now between those two guys. I actually had Gasol and Rudy Gobert as my technical front court fillers, and then had Cousins next, but I think those are the next three guys, yeah. However you want to slice
it. And I'm going to put a lot of these guys in the same tier. Another one in this tier would be Klay Thompson for me. LaMarcus Aldridge would be in that tier, Mike Conley, Gordon Hayward, and Damian Lillard, and I think CJ McCollum maybe would be in that tier as well. Eric Gordon and Eric Bledsoe I give a little consideration to, but not a ton. They wouldn't really be merit much of a second look yet.
Like, those guys are wonderful players, but they're not good enough to make this team. This is an absolutely stacked conference in terms of making the All-Star game. So if we put Gobert, Gasol, and Cousins in, that fills those spots, and then basically, we have two wildcard spots, because technically speaking, we have one, but then we have the injury replacement for Chris Paul. You laid out your tier. I don't have any arguments with what that tier is. Do you want to repeat it, or do we want to just...
Well, all right. So my last picks here, I went with... I had Gobert in there as well. So that's... We're down to the wild cards now. And I went with LaMarcus Aldridge as my last wild card.
Interesting.
Just because of, like, what he's contributed to the Spurs, he probably has a better track record than anyone else in this group that we're talking about, I would say. He's been an underrated defensive player. They've been effective, especially when he hasn't been tethered to Pau Gasol. He had some dominant games in the playoffs last year. You know, he started a little bit slow shooting, but I'm not going to take too much off for him there. And the Spurs, of course, are having another wonderful season that plays into it as well for me. Again, this was very hard. I'm not saying this is at all obvious.
These guys are all in the same tier. So I didn't have LaMarcus making my team at all, but he's like one of the first cuts out. And so for me, the top guy in that remaining tier was actually Gordon Hayward. I was surprised. Originally, I had Klay Thompson there, you know, the Warriors afterglow. But Gordon Hayward has been more efficient. His true shooting percentage is 599 over Klay's 582. And he has a bigger role. Both, you can look at that. I mean, Klay's usage is high, but that's just because he shoots almost every time he touches the ball. But in terms of creating for himself and others, and while Klay's defensive reputation outstrips Hayward's, there is a difference there, but I don't think that's nearly enough to fill that gap. So I think Hayward has had a bigger part in Utah's success than LaMarcus has for the Spurs. Those teams are close. Utah dealt with a ton of injuries. Hayward had to take on a larger role with George Hill being out. I thought Hayward has had the best year out of all of those guys. Is he your last guy?
No, he did not make it for me. I had Klay Thompson as the injury replacement.
Interesting.
And I actually, I guess we should talk
about... So we disagree on both of these then.
Yeah, well, we should talk about Gobert too. I think for a lot of fans, he would be like, why is he ahead? And my reasoning for him is, even with George Hill missing a lot of time, Derek Favors missing a lot of time, when he's on the floor, they just defended an unbelievable level, you know, like way better than the best defense in the league. Like, he just makes a good defense by himself. And this year, offensively, he's been effective. He's had, I think, has the highest field goal percentage in the league. He's been a great rebounder on both ends as well. Been able to stay on the floor by not fouling as much. Really, really improved his finishing around the basket. When he gets bumped now, he can actually go up and score. His free throw shooting is better now. He's shooting in the 60s, where it's enough that he's not scared to get hit anymore. I think that's really helped him. So while he is not, and I guess DeAndre Jordan could be in this discussion a little bit too. Why do we like Gobert over Jordan? I think that just Gobert is a much better defensive player. Just the restricted area field goal percentage for Utah opponents is like 54% this year, which is like 6% below league average, best in the league.
And also Gobert is more able to block shots and affect shots. In many ways more important than blocking shots without sacrificing defensive rebounding. He's
locked in all the time. DeAndre at his absolute best is close to Gobert, but he's not there all the time.
I think right now we would both have Gobert as defensive player of the year. So I mean that
Draymond
says more
would
than
probably enough. Be my number two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they both make it in, and Draymond's a better offensive player, so he's a little bit higher in this road and has a better track record. Gobert's there. So yeah, I think Gobert is there. And so you had Klay Thompson getting that last spot. I had Mike Conley getting that last spot, and I don't care that much about the time missed between those guys. It's there when you're that close. I think more about
it's 11 games,
but I think more about
the role
that you have. And so Memphis, you know, they're a little bit lower in terms of the offensive rating and everything like that, but they have scored 106 points per 100 possessions when Mike Conley has been on the floor, 106.2 before tonight's game against the Raptors, and that's pretty good. That will put them 13th in the league. It's just that he missed some time, and their second unit generally can't score. I don't hold any of that against him. He has a much harder role, I would say, than Klay Thompson, and I think that he has done a nice job of it. And defensively, he's a part of one of the most successful defenses, just like Klay is.
Yeah, I went with Klay for a couple of reasons. And remember, this is the injury replacement. We're talking about the 13th guy now already.
Right.
And again, this was very difficult. I can't remember a time when I've struggled this much. I mean, these guys all are just like separated by this much. And there's really like six or seven guys. Like this tier goes like really deep. So the reason I went with Klay, I think that just he has a track record a little bit more of being better than Conley. I think he also is underrated. The fact that he's able to, you've noticed that he shoots the ball every time he touches it, but he also scores so many points with so little touch time.
Right.
And that actually is what makes this team go to have a
third. And that's a skill.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, he is the best guard in the league by far at cutting. He gets like more points than anybody in the league from the guard position cutting to the basket. Obviously, his catch and shoot game is great. And I think when he really locks in defensively, he's outstanding. So, some ways, like for example, the that game against Portland where CJ McCollum had like 25 in the first half, he like locked him down in the second half. And yeah, the advanced numbers don't like Klay that much, but that's because he doesn't get a lot of blocks or steals. That's not what he's asked to do on this team. A lot of that still is based on the box score stat, and so I think that Klay is usually in there against the best guard from the other team. So I think his defense is very good, and I would trust my eyes over the advanced stats in that particular case.
I do too. That's why I think it's a really close circumstance. I just have Conley a little bit above, and I will also note to definitively that I do not care in terms of this at all about Conley being arguably the best player who has never made an All-Star team. I don't care about that at all. If you deserve it, you make it. If you don't deserve it, you don't.
No, I agree with that. My hardest omission actually would have been Damian Lillard.
And interesting. So you have just, Lillard over Conley.
Yes. And that's just because I think Lillard is a better player than Conley. I think Conley's defense has not been so great this year. I think that Lillard is just by far the hardest to guard of these guys. He's a guy who I think when he's out there can make an efficient offense almost by himself. You know, he's averaging 25 a game. He's efficient. He does have some defensive struggles, but I think if he had more help around him, he could be better.
Well, and it's a point guard. You don't worry as much about that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, now when you're paired with another point guard has the same defensive struggles, it can be a little bit different. But I just, you know, again, this is another thing with the track record, what Lillard did down the end of last year in the playoffs. It was very impressive to me, and that's kind of the tiebreaker when we're talking about these guys all being right at the same level. That's why Hayward, Conley couldn't quite get in there for me. Hayward would have been my next omission. Conley, the missed time hurt him as well for me a little bit more maybe than for you.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, I understand the argument for it. I just think at that point you go kind of best overall player, and this isn't, we're not giving the award for MVP, it's All-Star. So I lean more towards most outstanding when as a tiebreaker, like I think that, but you can also argue that Lillard has been more outstanding than Conley. So I mean, this is a brutally hard decision. And what I wanted to ask you about this is, did this decision making process change your opinion at all in terms of how the league should structure the All-Star in terms of East versus West versus doing an overall like pick 30 dudes?
Well, I would probably go with 24, but yeah, I think I wouldn't like it to be structured by conference. I would just like the best 24 guys to be picked for the team, and then you can just distribute them for the actual game however you want. The idea that anyone is watching because it's like competitive between East or West and they have huge rivalry, you know, I would love to see NBA versus the world in like a real game, but you know, it's never going to be a real game. So that whole thing, I would like to see that, because then you don't get things like seven-time All-Star Joe Johnson, because the East just isn't that good, you know.
Register trademark. But yeah, it's a challenge to do this in the format. And even though All-Star is not a consideration anymore in terms of the Rose Rule or designated veteran extensions, it still does matter, not only for player contracts, but as you said, for legacy pieces like making the Hall of Fame. And to have a player like Mike Conley, who largely has not made an All-Star team because he happens to play in the West, and you want to go a step further, he happens to play in the West because the league chooses to have Memphis in the West despite being further east than some of the other teams. If they had chosen to realign, when he was earlier in his career, he would have made a couple All-Star teams.
If you have any comments on that, if we snubbed your guy, give us your best argument. We will take that argument and reject it. But at least in a nice way, we'll at least explain why we disagree.
And we've considered a lot of these different players, and like it's a testament to how great the league is now that there are players who are deserving who aren't going to make it in, and maybe not in the East as much, but just overall.
Even in the East, this is like the first year I would say that I felt like, all right, we feel pretty good about all these players.
Yeah, it's true. Like if in last year year, if you transported Joel Embiid's year into last season, he absolutely makes the All-Star.
Yeah, there have been some bad years for the East, and I think, well, part of it too is just the East doesn't have as many really terrible teams this year, which helps matters. Anything else you wanted to say on All-Star?
Well, there's a question that ties in from this from Twitter from earlier in the day, at ACS Spotlight 95, and this is also something I would love to see as an All-Star game event. Which two players in the league would you most like to see play one-on-one?
Oh man, I gotta think about this one. Let's take this question first.
Sure.
From Tanny Ram, disappointed in your LA, LaMarcus Aldridge, and Dame choices, Nate. Sorry, I'm sorry to disappoint you. And I could see why that would be the case. I think those guys, clearly an anti-Portland or former Blazer bias with the commenter. But, I mean, Portland has not been good. I kind of violated my own rules there. I just, I believe in Dame Lillard as a player. I think he was unbelievable last year. I don't think that his performance has changed this much, so much this year that, I think he's arguably even been better. He's improved his finishing. He's not the problem with Portland. I didn't want to penalize him for that.
It's incredible how close CJ McCollum, when I started thinking about this, how close CJ McCollum got to Damian Lillard in terms of consideration. I didn't have either one of them on my team, but that McCollum has basically jumped into this conversation is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, CJ just doesn't do anything other than score. I think Dame is a little bit better distributor. He also gets to the rim. CJ just does not get to the rim, doesn't put pressure on the defense that way.
Right, and Lillard has a bigger role to shoulder and has done a good job of it overall.
All right, this one-on-one question is a tough one. I mean, I think you'd like LeBron to be in there for sure.
Yeah, I was thinking LeBron Durant. I think those two guys, if their lives depended on it, just to see them if fully engaged on defense and offense, both crafty guys. I actually would love both those two in a two-on-two setting as well. I think LeBron's, yeah. In some ways, LeBron is great in all settings, but either if we're going NBA Jam, we're going whatever, I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I wonder what the rules are, right? If you have a shot clock and it's a short shot clock, a one move type of one-on-one game, which I think is kind of more approximates 5-on-5 basketball in some ways, where you can't just back down and go shoot a short hook shot because the guy's smaller than you. I think LeBron would certainly have an advantage, more of an advantage the longer time that you could take, whereas KD, if he would be able to pull up, shoot the jumper a little bit more, shoot three-pointers, I think he could have a little bit of an advantage, right? I think you got to be at least 6'7" and strong, or you're just going to get bullied too bad in a one-on-one game like that. Kawhi Leonard is someone who could be in that conversation too.
Well, here's a nuance to split on this. If you had to take guys who are traditional centers or 7 feet tall, what one-on-one would you like to see?
Oh, everyone has to be over 7 feet tall?
Cousins Embiid would be fun, Towns, basically any one of that troika would be a blast, and Kristaps, of course, there are a lot of good guys.
All right, some other comments here. EIB Brooklyn, Steph Curry is the most overrated player in NBA history. No, that's probably Isaiah Thomas, actually, I would say. Detroit Isaiah Thomas.
Well, I mean, Stephen Curry last year had one of the greatest offensive years in NBA history. You don't even need to qualify.
It was a top 5 regular season in NBA history.
Was the unanimous MVP and deserved to be the unanimous MVP. He's the greatest shooter of all time, and point guard defense is broadly less important than offense.
Yeah, and he does do well off the ball, and he's one of the best off-ball point guard defenders, help defenders, up there as the league leader in steals all the time. And I mean, I'm sorry, the Warriors scored at historic rates whenever he's on the floor. There's a reason for that, and the idea that he has been terrible in the clutch, in 2015 he had some really good clutch moments. That Blazers series he had really good clutch moments. The last three games of the Oklahoma City series he was excellent despite fighting through an injury. That game 7 against Oklahoma City is one of the greatest playoff games anyone has played.
And also during the 2015-16 regular season. So if the argument is that he wasn't great in the clutch when he was not 100%, I will concede that point.
He had a shitty final. He had a couple of bad games in the 2015 finals, which didn't help things either, but I still thought he should have been the MVP of that series.
Agreed.
No, that is incorrect. Steph Curry was the unanimous MVP. He averaged 32 a game or 30 a game and had one of the highest PERs. I mean, there's no argument that he didn't have one of the greatest regular seasons ever last year, and I thought he was a deserving two-time MVP. Nobody was saying anything about him being overrated until after he hurt himself, and then they lost in the final.
Yeah, it's and being the greatest shooter of all time is something that is getting closer to being inarguable. He has such a versatile jump shot because he has even though his off the dribble stuff hasn't been as good this year, the level that he set for himself is ludicrous. And then catch and shoot, he's one of the best guys in the league.
Be Brooklyn, you might be getting close to being banned. We'll see what your next comment is.
At David, or this is a Periscope question. David_IDELE, are you shocked by the gap between KD and Steph now? No, I Kevin Durant is a spectacular player, and Stephen Curry has not been as good as he was last year, and he's getting closer to 2014-15 levels right now.
Yeah, I mean, since the Christmas game, I think he's been pretty close to the level that he was at last year. I mean, he hasn't had times where
he's been more
crazy.
Like 14-15, like maybe the year where he had the high level of play, but very few of that just like ludicrous explosion, all that. I think that's the baseline that I think we're getting, or not baseline, but that's the expectation that we're getting towards.
I think he's still a better offensive player than KD, actually. Now, KD probably has made up that gap and then some with the way he's played defensively and on the boards this year. But I think he's a better, if you look at their on-off numbers too, I think just the threat that he poses still is so much more. Whereas KD, I don't know that he's going to score one-on-one and beat you, but he's not creating quite as many opportunities. He doesn't freak out the opposing defense as much as Steph.
Yeah, like the way that you can think about this is, we talked about it with Rudy Gobert. That was defensively, but it's, does their presence alone make you a good offense in this case? Durant, the answer is not definitively true, but it's, you know, he certainly helps. Curry, I think the answer is yes. Curry being on the court in the form that he has been in since Christmas, you are going to have a good offense. And that's great, but Durant is the better overall player right now because he's a very good defender at his best. I wouldn't say he's like all defense or anything like that, especially because he's not engaged enough of the time when you compare him to players like Draymond or like Rudy Gobert, obviously. But the gap is large enough. I mean, we even saw that tonight when Curry struggled with Kemba. Like, Durant doesn't have that as much.
All right, that's enough on Steph Curry for this episode, by the way. So sorry if you asked any more Steph Curry questions, we are going to ignore that. Let's get to some other more general NBA questions that we had a good stack of those here.
Sure. This is one that just, it's near and dear after my heart, from @JohnEmilianoff. Other than inconvenience of moving the seats and repainting, what are the downsides of widening the court?
I don't think really anything. Well, there's this idea that you're going to have less revenue. That's one. And it's more than repainting also. I think in the hockey arenas, you could probably do it pretty easily. Although you do have like the hockey boards to deal with. I'm not sure how far back those are to whether that could impact the benches.
It might get, the concourse width might actually become part of an issue. And the stadiums that are basketball specific are there. And also the idea that, you know, bending it back, presumably that also might change if you're either going to create more space along the 3-point line or make it an actual arc, either like you can do.
Yeah, no, I mean, there just needs to be more room in the corner because guys just step out of bounds there all the time. It's like three turnovers a game now. And it's because there just isn't, I mean, these guys have, you know, shoes that are a foot and a half long and they've got like 2.5 feet to stand there. Like, you're going to step out of bounds in that corner. And there's also no reason for that to be a shorter shot in the corner either. That doesn't really make any sense. I think I would love to see the court widen, but just because you actually would have to make some structural changes to a lot of these arenas to accommodate that. The idea that it would lead to less revenue, that doesn't really make sense to me, because you would actually have more courtside seats. You would actually have like a wider court
you'd gain baseline seats, but baseline seats are still revenue because the court isn't getting shorter, so you still have that stays exactly the same as long as you don't lose a row on the sideline. But I would sincerely doubt that you would.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. So I would like to see that, but we're not going to, because money.
Yeah, and because there's so much logistical work that would go into that, and you would talk about the revenue side of it. That's actually the way that it might cost the most money.
You know, it would be nice to see if it could get tested in the D League. I think that's actually an executive
and summer league.
Yeah, an executive was complaining to me the other day that the D League has not been proactive enough in trying out new stuff. Like, I'd like to see the D League try out things like expanding the charge circle, and they just haven't done that.
Okay, another question from from @ZannyGlover, which I still like that handle. What do you guys think about Rashawn Holmes, and how would you solve the Sixers' big logjam?
Rashawn Holmes is a good backup center, and I would be trying to potentially trade for him. He's on a minimum contract the next 2 years with a team option on the second of those years, so you could either make him a restricted free agent agent or hold on to him at the minimum for another year, and then you have a very small cap hold. That is a very useful asset to have for the next 2 years. I think he could be a good backup center, get up for some alley-oops. He's a great shot blocker, improving defensive rebounder, little skinny maybe in some matchups, but no, I really like him a lot, and a guy who might be able to improve his jumper as well.
You wait him out because presumably they're going to end up moving one of the three at the bare minimum, and then he's your third string guy, and if you get good offers on Noel and Okafor, you move both, or if Noel gets offered
even if
too
you
much.
Get mediocre offers on them, yeah. I think at this point.
And then I wouldn't move Rashawn Holmes until there might actually be an avenue if a center gets hurt either in training camp or at the beginning of next season, or if the guy who becomes available in the draft at some point, you know, with whatever picks they end up with, if they get a great fit for backup center and that player works, then you can start to consider it a little bit differently. But I think the idea to solve it is that Rashawn Holmes is a great fallback. He's a great safety net so that you can move any number of those guys and you don't suffer that much in the consequences.
Another one from David Adele. Which NBA team is the best jersey?
Are we talking about default jersey? I'll phrase it this way. My favorite jerseys in the NBA are jerseys that are not presently used, and that is the blue city jerseys for the Warriors. They use the yellow ones. The yellow ones are fine. They're not nearly as good. Those are great, but they're not
Bulls red road jerseys.
Oh, those are really the with the script.
The old school ones. I mean, I like those. I actually just like kind of the regular
they're
one.
They're both
though.
Nice.
And I mean, the like Bull logo on the shorts. Those are the best shorts in the NBA.
Yeah, I like the Bulls. I like their color combination. I like their home and road like dual set. Like we're talking what the team wears for 82 games. If we can burn their gray jerseys with fire, then
yeah, any gray jersey when gray is not one of your team colors, which is basically no team,
or just any gray jerseys, just end them all.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, those make money, right? Like when you go to a Warriors game, those slate night jerseys, those are like a third of the. I mean, whatever, man. Like that's the sort of thing we were talking about the ads on jerseys last night on Dunked On too. Like I don't really, it doesn't bother me that they're doing what's going to make money. I think like the players deserve to make more money.
Sure,
like, no problems with the owners making money. Like it doesn't really affect things
as long as you don't make them wear sleeve jerseys.
Yeah, well, as long as you're not just screwing up the action on the court, I really don't care that much about a lot of aesthetics, frankly.
Yeah, I would like to see the NBA. I don't know the exact terminology on it, but I would love to see the NBA relax the restrictions on going back to past designs. The Hawks have done a great job of splitting the atom here by getting close enough to the old stuff where it doesn't violate the current rules, but still looks a lot like it with the logo. I don't see the issue with making a Dwight Howard jersey with those awesome old Hawks colors, like with the old Pistol Pete Maravich ones, which I actually think are one of the coolest color combinations that the Hawks ever did. Or, I mean, the Jazz with the mountain jerseys or the Nuggets with the skyline. Like, those to me are some of the most beautiful jerseys in the history of sports. If that team wants to go back to that exact style, let them do it. New names on the back of the jerseys, those will sell too.
All right. One more question here from Brown Hops. This is using that hashtag Twitter NBA show. Are Looney and McCaw dependable rotation players going into next season?
Dependable's tough for Looney because I don't know exactly what he does well enough to say there. Like, he's a good rebounder, but I don't trust him defending fives or defending fours or stretching the floor. So I don't think he's at that level. I think he's more like your fifth big than your third or fourth. McCaw is smart. I think he'll get better physically. And I'm not sure I'd call him dependable, but I think you know a low, like a baseline of what he'll be. And that's okay.
A lot of it's going to depend on what happens with Kevin Durant. If he wants to get paid his max, that means they probably cannot afford to bring back Livingston and Iguodala. We'll see what happens. Petrullian West will be free agents, whether they want to return as well. So I think whether they're dependable or not, I think the Warriors probably will be depending on them if Durant wants to get his max. Otherwise, they could just stay over the cap and re-sign Livingston and Iguodala, assuming that their prices are not too exorbitant. So I would think I would be okay trying them out if they have good summer leagues. Although I guess by that point, you'll have already had your chances to sign people. But maybe you give them a shot. And if they can't make it, you can make a move at the deadline. Hope that they can come through. I do think both of those guys are really weak right now. I think they have good basketball.
Physically weak, just
yeah,
to clarify.
Right, they have good basketball IQs. McCaw just needs to not only get stronger, as we talked about, but he just needs to get tougher. Like, you saw him on some of those switches today. Like, he really is going to kill your switching defense. Like, he needs to get stronger so he can do that. He's real thin. But then also, when he gets, like, in the post on a guy, he's not not like trying to fight Arana, make his life difficult. He just kind of deactivates and doesn't want to fight because he just assumes that he's going to be too weak to actually win that battle. But you got to just keep working, keep having some activity.
And that also buys time for the help to come, which is at bare minimum.
Yeah, I mean, even when we're talking about before the guy gets the ball, you got to try and fight around, or, you know, I mean, he just kind of backs up. Like, he's not, at least, like, try to be strong and get knocked backwards. Like, he just kind of, like, moves out of the way, it seems like. Almost.
Yeah, and so, and also, McCaw, I think he can be a cog in at least the second unit machine. He moves the ball relatively well. He has a lot of confidence in his jump shot, and it waxes and wanes a little bit in terms of whether it goes in or not. At the bare minimum, I think he can be an imperfect replacement for Ian Clark, and has the potential to eventually be more than that. It's also really fascinating because he has that contract, which is...
Clark did not play today, by the
correct.
Way. That was interesting.
Yeah, McCaw has 2 years at the minimum, and then is a restricted free agent with early bird rights, so like Jordan Clarkson, he will be subject to the Gilbert Arenas provision, inspired by then-Warrior Gilbert Arenas. So that all comes into play, not in terms of his role, but just in terms of thinking about where he is on this team in the long term. But it will be very hard, no matter which way the Warriors do it. It's a lot better if Durant chooses to take that financial sacrifice, but it's going to be hard for them to add depth players anyway, and they're going to have other priorities, backup center, maybe even starting center. Like, those things are more important than backup two guard.
All right, let's wrap it up here. Thanks so much for watching. You can follow me on Twitter at NateDunganNBA. If you want to get an alert of these shows, you can click on my name in the Paris or the Twitter mobile app. There's a little bell next to my name, drop down menu, and you can click on alert when this user goes with live video, so you can get alerted. You don't have to watch out for it on Twitter, and follow Danny at Danny LaRue.
And we are going to do a special, but hopefully we can make it more regular, Sunday show, because Thunder at Cavs is going to be a pretty significant game. So that will be Sunday the 29th. We will be back for that, doing a halftime and a postgame show, because there's only one game. So that'll be fun to get all that together, and we'll have a lot to discuss, hopefully.
All right, we'll be back then.